Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight for a discussion of Roadhouse by a man we all thought would be bigger, Adam Riske.
Hola, mijo.
You can find our website at fthismovie.net. You should follow us on Twitter if you don't already. We are at fthismovie. You should like us on Facebook, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us in the iTunes store just by searching F This Movie, but we're at almost 200 shows now, and I think only the 100 most recent are in iTunes. So if you want to find all of our old episodes to hear what I sounded like as a baby, you got to go to fthismovie.net and click on the podcast tab for all of our past episodes.
How far are you from 200?
Only like 3 or 4, I think.
Do you have special plans for number?
Not right now.
Double deuce?
No, right now I don't. I feel bad because we made such a big deal out of 100. We invented F This Movie Fest, like, really just to celebrate 100 shows, and now we're at 200. I'm just like, it'll be...
We could watch Twins.
Okay, yeah, that wouldn't be so bad.
There you go.
So we're going to talk about Roadhouse shortly, but first, Adam Riske.
Yes.
Have you seen anything good lately?
I have. Okay, so I saw 2 movies in theaters that were really good, and I saw 2 movies on Netflix, which I have mixed feelings
about. All right.
All right, so I saw The Hunger Games: Catching Fire.
Ooh, the number one movie in the country this weekend.
The new hotness, if you will.
Nice.
The new hotness, Everdeen. And it was good. I liked it a lot. I thought that it had a solid cliffhanger. It was like a rebuke on the Matrix Reloaded's cliffhanger.
Oh, okay.
Where it made you more interested in future chapters as opposed to less interested.
See, I did not mind the Matrix Reloaded cliffhanger. I didn't so much like the Matrix Revolutions, like the movie that delivered on the cliffhanger.
That's because you're normal.
The cliffhanger itself didn't bother me so much.
Okay.
Because it suggested that Neo now had powers in the real world, which I thought was cool.
That might have gone over my head the first time I saw it. And I didn't see Reloaded again until after I had seen Revolutions.
Okay.
So when I saw The Matrix Reloaded's cliffhanger the first time, I was just like, this is a big jumbled mess.
Yeah, well,
and
that's true.
You could definitely tell that they kind of were making it up as it goes along a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yes. But Hunger Games: Catching Fire I liked better than the first movie. I think the actors kind of maybe up their game a little bit for the second one. They seem to be taking it more seriously.
Okay.
And because one complaint that I always have about these, you know, big tentpole movies with really impressive casts are I would really love to see this cast in a movie worth this cast.
Right.
And in this case, it didn't bother me very much. I think it's a movie that starts out pretty well and, like, the action scenes are shot better than the first one. But it gets more interesting as it goes along. And I haven't read the book, so I was pretty surprised by the turns that it took.
Right.
And, it's, kind of out of the shadow of just being the poor man's battle royale to me now.
Right.
So I heard that the third book isn't as good.
I did not love it, but I didn't love Catching Fire either.
I'm hearing the movie's better than the book from a lot of people, so I'm hoping that the third one follows suit. So I enjoyed it. It's kind of in my November run of managing expectations, so I was just like, this just has to be as good as I Am Legend, and and I'm all set, and it was. So.
Better or worse than I Am? Like, where does this rank Francis Lawrence-wise?
I've only seen Constantine, which this is better than.
Okay.
And I am a fan of I Am Legend.
Interesting.
Outside of the special effects.
So you did not see Water for Elephants?
I did not see Water for Elephants.
I think I Am Legend has a really good, like, first 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I need to see Hunger Games: Catching Fire. I'm not dying to see it now that people are coming out of it and really liking it. Obviously, that gives me a little bit of hope.
Mm-hmm.
I find that I feel like I need to see it more to be part of sort of the cultural conversation than because I care at all what happens, because I don't. But maybe that's because I read the book and I already know. I don't know.
Yeah. It'll be kind of a pokey weekend next weekend with Thanksgiving releases, so you'll have time to catch up.
Yeah, but next weekend's Old Boy.
I want to see that just because it's Spike Lee.
And I'm fascinated.
But the fact that there's, like, no early reviews for it is usually a bad sign.
Yeah, well, and Josh Brolin has already come out and said that they took an hour out of it, and he's not happy with the cut that's being released.
Yeah, but he's also a fall-down drunk who had to go into rehab recently.
True, again. Yeah. No, that is true, but I don't know what... There's no way that a faithful remake gets made in Hollywood, right? I mean...
I don't think so.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, Elizabeth Olsen's pretty cute, though, mm-hmm. so, I mean, mm-hmm. like, who knows? Maybe he hooks up with her still.
A lot of interesting choices.
You got Homefront next weekend, I guess.
Oh, yeah. And I should probably see it, like, to write a heavy action on it, but... Ugh.
That's kind of your life.
And Frozen is supposed to be great, actually.
Yeah.
Super good reviews for Frozen.
Yeah, I'm hearing that, too.
Now I feel like I gotta see that.
That's gonna be, like...
Damn
one
it!
Of, that, if I see that, that'll be one of my Midnight Shame movies, where I'm like, there's no kids around, right? Because I don't want to look like the dirty old man right. who goes to see Frozen.
Yeah, right. So, what was the other movie in the theater that you saw?
Well, I already talked to you over email about this one, but I want to give a shout out to The Best Man Holiday.
Yeah.
Which I don't have much of a history with the Best Man franchise.
which
but,
it is now. Can you believe that?
Yeah. And they're talking about making a third one, which I'd be completely fine with. and I saw the first one the day before I saw the second one. Okay. And I thought it was probably what everybody thought it was in 1999.
It's like a fine hangout movie.
Yeah. Right? But it's not something where, like, you really care to see these characters again.
Right.
But the second one really kind of enriches a lot of the characters, and they do things in the second one that I won't go into, but it kind of makes the going back to the first one, I believe, kind of tough to do because they go into such a melodramatic direction.
Right.
But it's really good melodrama,
okay.
and I'm not opposed to that. Very often, like, if it's done well, I usually can go along with what the filmmakers are doing, and it's set, by far as managing expectations again, it is Malcolm Lee's best movie. So
better than Undercover Brother?
It is better than Undercover Brother.
I'm not a big Undercover
Brother. I'm not that much either. But, yeah, no, I think... And this is more just because the stock of Christmas movies has been pretty thin in the past few years. But this is probably the best Christmas movie I've seen in several years.
Oh, wow.
And I just like the cast a lot. I think Morris Chestnut's really good and Terrence Howard's really good. So
Taye Diggs
is fine, but he's not as good as some of the other people in there. Nia Long is still smoking at, like, age 40, and the soundtrack is good. And
I always thought Taye Diggs should have a bigger career than he had.
I think Taye Diggs also thinks that, too.
I really like him in a lot of stuff. Like, he's one of my favorite parts of Go.
Oh, man.
Which is, I know, a movie you just talked about. I like Go.
I want to like Go more than I like
Go. I do like Go. I think, I don't think the movie as a whole is great, but, I mean, Sarah Polley's great, and Taye Diggs is great, and Tim Oliphant is great.
I was convinced Jake Gyllenhaal was in that for the longest
time.
You know, the guy who's, like, tripping on what he thinks is ecstasy and his baby aspirin? I thought that was, like, Bubble Boy Gyllenhaal.
That's the kid from Fargo, right?
Is it?
It's William H. Macy's son in Fargo.
You're right. Yeah. Okay. All right. But, yeah, so Best Man Holiday.
All right. Cool.
Check it out.
Nice. Do you think for the third movie they should go, like, action? If they kind of went romantic comedy, now melodrama, I think they should switch up the genre again. Heist movie?
Well, also you got
the
Wedding.
Best Man Job?
Wow. that sounds like a movie I don't want to see. You've got... And no disrespect. If you want to see The Best Man Job, have at it. No, but you have Wedding, Christmas, romantic comedy, melodrama.
Okay.
So you have to have, like, an event with a genre pairing.
Oh.
So let's go with St. Patrick's Day.
Okay, I like it.
And
Intervention, The Best Man Intervention.
Gothic horror.
Oh, all right. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to stay in this haunted house.
Yeah.
On St. Patrick's Day night.
Like, Morris Chestnut's mansion is haunted.
Yes. All the faucets flow with green
It is
blood.
It is sure. It was great. Philadelphia Eagles blood because he plays for the New York Giants.
What did you watch on Netflix?
I watched
questionable.
The Killing Season with Robert De Niro and John Travolta. All
right.
And it's basically like a direct-to-video version of The Hunted.
Okay.
Did you like The Hunted?
I don't think I ever saw The Hunted.
Okay.
When I went on my Friedkin kick a couple months ago, I watched like the first half hour, and I thought what I saw was okay, and then I never finished it.
It's better than its reputation would suggest.
Okay.
But I only saw it the one time when it first came out. But Killing Season is a movie that's kind of at odds with itself because it wants to be this exploitation movie, like a really violent kind of James Wan Death Sentence exploitation movie.
Okay.
But then it also turns into this is the toll that war takes out on soldiers drama. And it gets a little sticky and gross. But the first 45 minutes of it are actually kind of cheesy fun because De Niro's like going in and out of a Southern accent and Travolta has an insane Serbian accent, I believe.
Oh, no,
it's either Bosnian
or I couldn't have passed
Serbian.
His facial hair.
Yeah, like, he's kind of got like goat hair. But they have this thing where they set up that De Niro is this loner and he lives out in this cabin in the woods, and his life consists basically of just kind of like walking around his grounds.
Okay.
Cooking pot pies and listening to Johnny Cash records.
Of course.
And then he goes out into the wilderness and his car breaks down. And then this nomad in the form of John Travolta basically is like, I could help you fix the car.
No.
And then he's just like,
I have to watch this movie.
Yeah. And then he reluctantly says, fine, you can help me fix the car. And then he invites him back to the cabin where he proceeds to cook him a pot pie. And they listen to Johnny Cash records together in bark loungers while they're getting drunk off Jägermeister.
Oh my god.
So it's kind of like how you and I met.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of does sound. It wasn't Johnny Cash, though. It was Debbie Gibson.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
I thought we were alone.
A movie that's Tiffany.
Oh, shit.
A movie that combines late period De Niro with late period Travolta is not high on my list of things to see.
Can I sway you to the other direction?
Yeah, please.
I read in the trivia for this movie that it was originally supposed to be a follow-up vehicle to Face Off to pair Nicolas Cage and John Travolta back together in a movie, but it was in turnaround for a long time.
And it eventually got made as this? What?
Yeah.
Are we
killing
out of
season.
Ideas? I don't understand.
It's killing season.
It looked
guys.
Like Travolta in Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 mode.
He's not as hysterical.
Okay.
I don't know. I've said in Netflix this movie that Travolta's, for better or for worse, mostly for worse, that he's still kind of my favorite actor.
Okay. What was the last really good Travolta movie or performance?
You have to dig deep into the archives for this one.
It's rough, right?
Yeah.
70s, great. Up
70s,
through, like,
great.
Blowout.
80s, great.
Not even 80s, great.
80 blowout, I think.
Blowout, and then Look Who's Talking.
I like Look Who's Talking.
That's it for 10 years.
Shit, you're right. I don't know. I was with him up until, like, The General's Daughter.
Yeah, that seemed to be when.
And then he kind of lost me.
He kind of was really phoning it in.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, Primary Colors sucks, but he's good in it.
I don't even hate Primary Colors.
I don't hate it, but it's not good.
It's probably not good. But
Civil Action's good.
Civil Action, I saw, I remember nothing about
it. Yeah, I don't remember a whole lot about it either.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, he went on that run with, like, Lucky Numbers and Battlefield Earth and General's Daughter.
Yeah, I skipped a lot of those. Swordfish. He's in Swordfish.
I'm not a fan of Swordfish. I do have a friend who still quotes Swordfish, like, people will understand what he's talking about.
I saw Swordfish the day it opened on a double bill with Evolution and
your own double bill.
Had an okay time at the movies that day, and I don't think I've seen either one of them since. But I didn't hate Swordfish when I saw it, but I don't feel compelled to rewatch it.
I might be a bad person, but like I kind of like The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
I missed it in theaters and saw it on DVD and thought it was okay.
Denzel
Washington tends to elevate that kind of thing
because you got that and you got like Gandolfini and John Turturro in it, so it's watchable enough.
Yeah. So Travolta might be the worst thing about it, actually.
He's a little silly in that one. And then the other thing I watched on... Or no, I didn't watch this on Netflix. It wasn't on Netflix, but I watched Blackfish.
Oh, okay. That was one of mine, too.
The documentary about saving the whales at SeaWorld. And I want to get your take first on Blackfish, so go ahead.
I thought a lot of the information that they conveyed was very powerful. I didn't know much about SeaWorld already. I've never been. There was enough said in the documentary that I thought, like, oh, that's barbaric. We're doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
There was some footage that was really, really tough to watch. Mm-hmm. The one sequence where the whale keeps pulling the guy down by his foot.
Yeah.
And then lets him go long enough to pull him down again was tough to watch.
Yeah.
So some really horrible stuff, but I thought it was kind of like not a very well-made movie.
I can agree with that.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of hear your take on it because it's been getting almost like universally good reviews, and then it aired on CNN.
Yeah.
And a lot of people on Twitter were saying how powerful it was, and I think that these people aren't really thinking too much about it. They're just kind of reacting to the images that they're seeing.
I think part of it, maybe, and maybe I'm speaking for people unfairly, but like... Yeah.
I'm fine doing that.
I think it presented people with some things that they didn't know. I think that they're reacting to, oh my gosh, SeaWorld might be kind of evil.
Yeah.
And so they're reacting to that and not the filmmaking.
Okay. All right. I got to go off on my little rant. If you'll allow me for 2 minutes to go off on my Blackfish rant.
I hate whales rant?
Oh, no. No. Although by the end of the movie, I kind of, like, if they handed me a gun, I probably would have shot Tika Moo or whatever his name was, because I just felt bad for him.
The one whale is like crying out for the other one.
Yeah,
it's so hard to watch.
Sure,
it's awful.
Here's the thing. Okay, I was really with the movie for the first hour.
Okay,
it's about an hour and 25 minutes.
Yeah,
but then by the time they show like the fourth victim thing,
yeah,
or they're describing somebody horribly mutilated by one of the whales because they're frustrated by their poor treatment.
Yeah.
Then I started thinking that the filmmakers were making a grief porn, and they wanted to exploit a lot of these horrible stories.
Sure. And
I don't think that they had any... And this bothers me, because I think a lot of new filmmakers make documentaries because that's what they can get made.
Sure.
And I think a lot of them don't necessarily maybe have as strong opinions as they presuppose that about the material. So they make this movie where they show all this horrible treatment of whales at SeaWorld, but they have no opinion about what to do about it. So they just basically go for 85 minutes saying, like, look how horrible this is.
Right.
And then they like go like that and clap their hands and then they wash their hands of it.
Sure.
All right. They showed like the Shamu dolls at the end being sold at SeaWorld. They never really talk about how basically that's the reason why they're making this movie, is because this flagship product of this $2 billion corporation is being done at the exploitation of animals and mistreatment of animals. The people who are from OSHA don't really get into too much detail about what they're doing to prevent this from happening.
Right.
They do a lot of interviewing with people from SeaWorld who are former employees who basically just said, oh yeah, we were really bad to them and I feel bad about it now. But that's like if a Nazi came to me and said, oh, yeah, we treated your ancestors really terribly, but we're really glad that you're doing podcasts now, so good for you. It's like, no, you fucking assholes. You were complicit in, like, the horrible treatment of these whales.
And there's really only, like, six of them that they interview. That's, I think, one of the movie's problems, too, is that it doesn't get, I think, a wide enough spectrum of opinions, that it's, like, the same six people sharing those stories. And actually, three of them are basically just sharing one story that sort of rolls out over the course of the entire film.
Yeah. And also, like, whales aren't the only animals being mistreated.
Right.
So I understand that you need to kind of narrow the focus of your movie, but there's not any mention of, oh, yeah, and there's a lot of other animals at SeaWorld that probably aren't being treated very well.
Right.
There's a lot of animals in zoos or at, like, petting zoos that, like, don't belong there.
Right.
And I just don't get what the point.
Well, I think at least in this, in the instance with this, in terms of the other animals, I'm sure there are other animals being mistreated at SeaWorld and at zoos or whatever. But in this case, it's like people are being killed by these animals, and it shouldn't be happening. It's not the person's fault. It's not really the whale's fault. It's the fault of this situation.
Yeah.
So let's use that as a way in to talking about this situation. But like you said, they don't really do such a good job of that.
And they also mentioned there about how in 20 years since like one incident compared to like a more recent incident that nothing's been learned.
Right.
Well, apparently nothing's been learned from Free Willy either, because at least Free Willy had a phone number at the end or a call to action, and Blackfish doesn't.
Yeah, it was problematic. Again, it told me some things that I didn't know, and the shots of like the whale who's like depressed at the end of the movie, that was really hard to watch, or hearing the way that SeaWorld tried to spin the story and blame it on the trainer because she had a ponytail or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
That's disgusting. You know, so every once in a while, my blood would get up because I would be outraged at something I was seeing, but I completely agree with everything you're saying.
Did you ever see Project Nim?
I did not.
That one's kind of the same thing, but done a little bit better, I think.
And that's with monkeys, right?
It's just this one ape from the 70s where they basically tried to raise it like it was a human child to see what would happen.
And I should not play favorites for one animal over another, but I have a stronger affection for monkeys than I do for whales. Not that I want to see whales suffer or be mistreated, but it would be harder for me to see a monkey be mistreated.
That monkey is charismatic. So go right ahead.
I saw Blackfish. Good. I saw another documentary called Narco Cultura about the drug war that's taking place in Mexico, and I don't even know what to say about it. It's a very well-made documentary. It's very sort of standoffish. It just films things and people and lets them talk. It's not like the filmmaker is inserting a really heavy-handed point of view the way that they do in Blackfish. Mm-hmm. You know, since I think 2006, I think 60,000 people, I think is what it says at the end of the movie, have been murdered in Mexico as part of the drug war. I can't even wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
So it basically follows one sort of law enforcement officer as he tries the incredible uphill battle of trying to make any progress in this drug war. All of his coworkers are being murdered and assassinated. Mm-hmm. He can't go out in public because he's afraid for his life all the time, but he just keeps saying, but this is the job and I do my job. And he's so noble and sad. And then on the other side, it follows a singer who's part of, and I wish I could remember this style of music. There's this style of music that's outlawed in Mexico that is sort of, they write like anthems for these drug dealers and murderers that help build their legend. And it's illegal, but they're incredibly popular. They play all these clubs. They play in the United States. They get a bunch of money. The guy's doing very well for himself. And so it's not Pitbull. it's crazy because I don't know a ton of, like Mexican music. Mm-hmm. But the style of it is very much the same style of like all the other music you hear. So it's a lot of like horns and accordion. You would never know that what they're singing about is he beheads his enemies and does all the mess. It's just maddening. Like, and it's interesting that that stuff is included. And I know it's there, you know, as a way of showing just how much more difficult the job is for these guys, because not only are they dealing with powerful drug dealers and corrupt institutions that allow this to happen, not only are they afraid for their lives, but there's an entire culture in Mexico that builds these guys up as heroes. Mm-hmm. And they keep talking about how they're the modern day Robin Hoods, but there's never an indication that any of these people are giving money to the poor. I don't understand why there's this hero worship, but it allows you to point your anger at these musicians, which probably isn't fair. Be like, why are you championing murderers and awful human beings?
Do they interview the musicians and ask them about it?
No, they don't. They don't.
So they're like not affiliated with the drug dealers. They're just,
drug dealers, will commission them to write songs about them.
Oh, okay.
But again, the filmmakers never insert, they don't ask questions on camera. They don't insert themselves.
The 60,000 number doesn't surprise me as much because I saw The Counselor, and I kind of get it.
I still haven't seen The Counselor.
It's underrated.
I came so close. No, it was Thursday was the last day it was playing anywhere in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I tried to go to the very last show, and I couldn't. But I really wanted to see it even after it was called The Worst Movie Ever Made by Salon.com.
No, that's ABC's The Death.
No, I saw a movie worse than that. I'll get to it in a second. Cool. Narcocultura is very depressing, very bleak, and very upsetting. I have a screener.
Oh, okay.
I think it's just now out in limited release.
And it's not the same movie as the one called Drug War, where it's like some dude smoking on the poster.
I don't think so. Okay, no. Right. It's very good, but again, tough to watch. Then I saw Blackfish. Oh, I finally saw Dead Man Down, which we don't really need to talk about because you talked about it a long time ago on a podcast.
Did you love it?
I did not love it. That's surprising. Enough. I was with it for like 40 minutes.
That's cool.
I think it's actually a well-made movie.
Yeah, I can see that.
It looks really good and it's directed well, but it makes no sense. It's impossible to care about any of the characters.
It's super drab.
It's very drab. And when Noomi Rapace reveals her motivations, which is actually pretty early on, it's ludicrous what she's asking, what she's demanding, and the fact that she's upset because she's hideously deformed. Meanwhile, she has like four scars on her face. Like, not to make light of anybody who has scars on their face, but Noomi Rapace looks fine even with the scars on her face.
Just so you know, like, I was over at a friend's house yesterday, and I was laying down on a couch, and his dog stepped on my face, and that's about as many scars.
Do you want me to murder someone for you now? The dog? You're like, you have to kill the dog, or I'll turn you in.
That dog was a real beagle.
So I won't talk about Dead Man Down too much. I saw Frances Ha.
Yeah, and?
Still processing it.
I hated it the first time I saw it, and then I liked it the second time, so I don't know where I'm at.
I didn't hate it, but I also didn't love it. I mean, I think I get the movie that it is. I think I understand exactly what Noah Baumbach is trying to say. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if I've moved past it.
Yeah,
like, in 95, when he made Kicking and Screaming, and I'm making up that year. It might not have been 95.
The one with Will Ferrell. I'm just kidding.
You know, that movie really hit me. And part of that is because it was just that 90s boom of, like, let's talk about stuff. And I feel like he's still sort of making that movie. Okay. I'm not saying every one of his movies has been that, but Frances Ha reminded me of that a lot. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like I'm on the other side of it now, and it's just hard to relate to any of it.
I think I rejected some of it the first time just because it felt very girls-esque.
Sure.
And I really didn't like her friends in that movie. I thought they were obnoxious.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of the point.
Absolutely.
So, the second time, I think I definitely saw it for, I'm going to name a title for another movie that I did not see, but she's a girl in progress. Mm.
No one saw Girl in Progress. It's interesting because I know the movie is very sort of polarizing and some people really hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand what it is that they are hating, but I also think they're not seeing past.
Yeah. They're seeing the part where she's spinning in the street to
exactly.
Modern
love. And the obnoxious dialogue. That's, but again, yes, the point is that these guys are sort of self-satisfied hipster douchebags. Then the last movie I'll talk about is a movie called Inappropriate Comedy.
No, you've watched that?
Inappropriate Comedy, but app is all capitalized because that's the hook of the movie.
Jeez, Patrick Bromley, choose different why do you do these things to
apps
yourself?
Because I feel like you need to see the good and the bad, the sour and the sweet. And I needed to see a movie written and directed by the ShamWow guy, which this movie is. Here's the thing. I've never seen a movie before that takes place entirely inside Lindsay Lohan's vagina, which this movie does.
I saw Freaky Friday, so I have seen two. I've seen one that takes place inside her vagina.
No one should ever see it, obviously. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And Adrian Brody probably should give his Oscar back just for participating in this. Surely, ShamWow guy has photos of Adrian Brody blowing a dog or
it would probably be okay
letting
if they just
a dog
released it.
Blow him. Oh, it would have been better than Inappropriate Comedy.
Yeah, because even if that happened, I think that would make like page 40 of Us Weekly. Like, no one would care. They'd be like, oh, I feel bad for that dog.
It's like a sketch comedy movie. And all these people out there who claim movie 43 is the worst movie of the year, you have not seen Inappropriate Comedy.
Did you watch movie 43?
I've seen movie 43, yeah.
It has a couple funny moments.
It's not good, but I do not think it's the worst at all. I've seen several movies this year worse than that. Every sketch in this is based on hating gay people or hating black people or hating Jewish people or hating women or hating Asians. The joke of every individual sketch is like, aren't these people ridiculous? It is the most sort of racist, homophobic, misogynistic, hateful, garbage comedy I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll throw this out real quick. I rewatched Adam Sandler's Eight Crazy Nights this morning.
Does it hold up?
I used to be a defender of that movie because I thought that it had some kind of a bizarro, silly charm to it.
It does not.
No. I used to really like the Whitey and Eleanor characters, the two older people.
Yeah.
Now I just feel bad for them, like, because they're, even when, like, they have the mea culpa at the end where we're supposed to be like, oh, we do value them, they're still making fun of them.
Right, of course.
It's, like, the most
mean. It's every, like, Adam Sandler movie.
But though. Every Adam Sandler movie, I hadn't seen every Adam Sandler movie in 2002.
Right.
I haven't seen, like, but 11 years of more information has proven to me that he is making fun of them as much as possible. And I it's one of those moments where you realize that you would not, like, 31-year-old Adam would never hang out with 20-year-old Adam. Like, never, ever, ever hang out with 20-year-old Adam.
I used to see pretty much everything that came out and saw Eight Crazy Nights the day it opened.
Was it packed?
I don't remember if it was crowded or not. I feel like it was actually kind of crowded. I love my wife very much. I don't think she would be upset if I mentioned that she cried during Eight Crazy Nights.
Yeah, what part?
Something was sad at the end. Maybe Whitey was upset, or maybe when the deer were pooing.
Or licking Whitey out of the ice poo.
I mostly just remember deer pooing and hating it.
Yeah.
But she definitely cried at something that was supposed to be moving, so that happened. I haven't seen it since. I saw it the day it opened and never since.
Yeah.
I'm okay, right?
You're set.
What a relief. Mm-hmm. Should we talk about Roadhouse finally?
I'd love to talk about Roadhouse.
All right, cool. Now, this was your suggestion for a podcast.
It was.
What kind of framework do you want to use to talk about Roadhouse?
Okay. Well, I don't want it to be a, like, Chris Farley show thing with Roadhouse, because I don't know how you feel about Roadhouse, but I think there's a lot of moments in it that make me laugh and are a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And it's a super crazy movie.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of, I think the framework that I kind of want to take are one of two.
Okay.
The first one is I want to get deep in the soil of Roadhouse and figure out why it works.
Okay.
And two, if you agree.
Okay.
And two is to talk about the value of a movie that isn't, in air quotes, good.
Right.
But can make you insanely happy.
Okay.
And if that, if a movie making you insanely entertained qualifies it enough to be good, even if it's not a movie that in premise be good.
Right. Yeah. Well, right. It sort of brings up this question of what is a guilty pleasure? Because at what point do you say, I don't feel guilty about liking something or enjoying this thing.
Yeah.
So therefore it's not a guilty pleasure. It's just a thing that I like or enjoy. Because I feel like I'm sure some people tuning in are expecting us to talk about Roadhouse. Just Roadhouse is one of these movies that has become embraced ironically, that Roadhouse is amazing because it's so stupid and it's so awesome because he rips out a guy's throat. And like, I'm trying to figure out how to talk about how I enjoy Roadhouse, because I mostly do, without it being just this ironic appreciation.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm stuck on that. But as I watched it again today, I thought, no, this movie is just entertaining.
Yeah.
Maybe because it does some crazy things, but believes in those crazy things, and that's part of what I like about the movie.
Yeah. One thing that I read in the trivia for on IMDb about Roadhouse, and I thought this was something that was going to be an original thought of mine, and when I saw it, I was really pissed off, is that Roadhouse is a updated Western. Hmm.
And, I had the same thought.
And I think that's not, if nothing else, just look at the deep bench of characters in this movie.
Right.
And each of these characters, even like the henchman number 8, has a moment or two where you kind of get their personality.
Sure.
And there's enough variety in there, and they have enough weird quirks.
Right.
Where every scene has two or three interesting kind of strange things going on.
Right.
In it. So I appreciate it from that standpoint. I also think that it's a movie where a lot of times you say like an action movie is as good as its villain.
Right.
And Roadhouse has a fantastic villain.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty ridiculous. I don't know. It's hard for me to watch Ben Gazzara sometimes play a villain after seeing Big Lebowski because
yeah, Jackie Treehorn.
I'm always just imagining that he's drawing cocks on things. But like
Brad Wesley probably is drawing cocks on things.
By the way, this is the second movie in a row that we've done on a podcast where the main villain's name is Brad.
Is it?
It was Brad Whitaker in The Living Daylights and Brad. There's just nothing threatening about these names. Brad Wesley.
No, no.
Nothing threatening about that name.
Okay, I got a place to start.
Okay.
Patrick Swayze as an action hero.
Yes.
He's kind of a pansy, right? And maybe that's why it works. Because he's kind of not the macho meathead guy?
Well, yes and no. I mean, no, he's not like alpha male. He's obviously the action hero that women sort of want to throw themselves at because it seems like he will listen to them and read them books. And he, even when he leaps off the thing towards the end of the movie when he's arguing with Kelly Lynch and something explodes and he runs outside, he does this leap off the porch that's really a ballet move. I mean, it's so sort of la. And he's got that thing. But again, part of what makes Patrick Swayze sort of great as an action hero, and I say that really only liking him here and in Point Break in terms of action movies.
Yeah, I haven't seen Next of Kin or
Next of Kin is no good. Black Dog is no good. I mean, he's made action movies that are garbage, but is how much wackiness he sort of infuses the characters with that you know sort of comes from his own his own system of beliefs. So you have the Buddhist bank robber in Point Break, and in here he's this philosophy. But he studies philosophy and he reads and he practices kung fu. I mean, he's just
And you know, like all of the choices where he's like, I want to have a scene where I'm doing Tai Chi outside and I'm greased up by the sunlight and two men are looking at me basically like quivering and biting their lip in anticipation of hot masturbation later for themselves. I mean, like, you know that was a Swayze idea.
Sure, and that's the thing, is that he is sort of this action hero who's sort of in touch.
He's a lover before a fighter.
Yeah, not that he's in touch with his feminine side, but his very participation sort of brings on a little bit of, like, a homoerotic subtext that wouldn't necessarily be there if they made this movie with Jason Statham, you know?
Right, right.
Because there are elements of that scattered throughout the movie, and I generally choose to ignore them. It's just when that last guy at the end says, like, I used to fuck guys like you in prison. I think, why did we throw that beat in there?
I misplaced his response to that.
I love all of his responses. Because they're so matter of fact, like, you're an asshole. Yeah. Fuck you. They're not snappy one-liners.
I always thought you're such an asshole was his response to I used to fuck guys like you in prison, but it was after Prepare to Die.
Right.
And I was disappointed by that because that would have been such a great response to I used to fuck guys like Greg in prison. You are such an asshole.
But I just love when after he kills that dude and he just screams out at Jackie Treehorn, just like, fuck you! Because that's what you would do. You would just be so frustrated. You wouldn't come up with some clever thing to say. You'd just be like, fuck you, asshole.
Well, he does when Tinker gets crushed by the polar bear. He's like, you belong with each other.
Yeah, right.
And it comes off like lead bricks falling out of someone's mouth.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's he's just such an interesting kind of guy for an action hero. And I think that a Chris Hemsworth or a Channing Tatum could be kind of the modern day equivalent of a Patrick Swayze. Yeah, like, maybe. I think either of them could be the kind of guy who would be in, like, did you hear they're remaking Roadhouse with Rob Cohen directing it?
I did.
Like, if they're going to do that, which they shouldn't do that.
They should not do that at all.
Then, but I would see, like, a Channing Tatum or a Chris Hemsworth playing Dalton.
And those are both good suggestions. They should not do it for a lot of reasons. Either one, they're going to misunderstand what made Roadhouse, what makes it special, and try and approximate it.
Yeah.
And it's going to come across as false and shitty.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're going to do, like, a Death Race 2000 Death Race thing where they completely don't understand the original, go in a different direction, and
they try strip to make it
away
gritty.
Strip away anything that's special, you know?
So, all right. Kelly Lynch.
Yeah.
She's kind of weird looking, right?
Sure. I thought you might like her because you have a Dern thing, and I think feel she like does. She's in the Dern family.
She is kind of in the Dern family a little bit, but I can't go over the fact that she kind of, like, all right, the scene where she shows up in the picnic dress.
Yeah, that's problematic.
She looks like a Sheltie.
Well, that's, they do a weird thing with her bangs.
Yeah.
She has a rough go of it in this movie, and I'm pretty sure she was miserable the whole time. Like, I think she regrets doing the movie. I think she had a bad experience making it.
Is that just, like, intuition, or do you...
No, I think I think I've heard her speak about it or read an interview with her where she definitely wanted to have a different kind of career, and then wound up in this movie playing a very thankless role. They do make her look kind of bad a lot of times.
Yeah, she looks really kind of like a stone puppy most of the time.
Yeah, her
she
performance makes is
really
very
weird facial choices.
Her performance is very flat.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't really have a ton of chemistry with Patrick Swayze, which is necessary because they're basically fucking on their second date.
Which is hilarious because she has chemistry with Sam Elliott. Like that, yeah, right? She like lights up that one scene. She's charmed like nothing else.
I can't get past when they have the stand-up sex that they're fucking against like a stone fireplace.
That's the part that bothers you.
Really seems like it would hurt.
It doesn't bother you that Doc, a physician, is having raw dog with a cooler?
Well, yeah. The original title for the movie, I think, Raw Dog with a Cooler.
I thought it was One Night at McCool's.
It just, nothing about it makes sense, how quickly they go to having sex, and I know it's supposed to be like a steamy scene, but it's very interesting when, because that's hard to, that's a hard thing to fake, and so you'll see a movie like, I can't think of an example of a movie where, like, that's a hot sex scene, but then when they try and fake it, it's Roadhouse or it's Showgirls, that crazy scene in the pool where it's like, no, guys, you can't fake this. This just has to happen on its own.
I also like how right before they have sex, the radio just happens to have, like, these arms of mine on.
Of course.
Like, because
any Otis Redding, any sort of Sam Cooke, anything will do.
Yeah. I've never had that look. I've always, like, had a girl be like, I've got, like, this J-Lo CD.
Right. It's always the B-52s.
Like, yeah, you have to, like,
boys in bikini, girls on surfboards.
Yeah, it's just like, all of a sudden it's like Drake, and he's like, please don't hurt me. And I was like, stop it, Canadian Jewish rapper.
Sam Elliott is an interesting presence in the movie. Again, he fits the part of, if we're updating a Western, he comes on as sort of the Doc Holliday, and he's very sort of authentic as a guy who's lived this life.
Yeah.
Every time I watch Roadhouse, I go through the same cycle of Sam Elliott. Where he storms into that one scene all beat up. Like, my memory is always that they murder Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
But then I forget for sure if they do. So he storms into the one scene all beat up, and I'm like, oh, no, they don't murder him. They just beat him up. He's fine.
Yeah.
And then two scenes later, it's like, oh, no, that's right. They do murder him two scenes later.
I always combine those scenes like he's stumbling in, and I think he has a knife in his back.
But he should, because the fact that those two things are broken up makes no goddamn sense at all.
No, it really doesn't. Here's the thing with Sam Elliott. Yes. It makes me extremely uncomfortable.
Okay.
Like, just as a viewer.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I had to ask your lovely wife, Erica, if girls are attracted to Sam Elliott, because I can't believe it.
I think there's definitely a kind of woman that is attracted to Sam Elliott. I think the kind of woman who, like, really wanted to go see Roadhouse on opening night definitely digs on Sam Elliott.
There's just too much, like, tired dog on a porch to him for me.
Right.
And it creeps me out. Like, every time he talks or does anything, like, I just always, I feel like it won't end well. So, like, and I feel that way about him throughout his entire career. Like, it doesn't matter what he's in. I just don't like Sam Elliott.
Just watching him on screen, I just, like, smell cigarettes and Old Spice.
So he smells like David Carradine in real
life? No, David Carradine smells like patchouli.
Actually, he smells like cigarettes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Not anymore.
He smells like patchouli now.
So Roadhouse is a super entertaining movie, but I will say that it dips in the middle. I feel like as the bar gets more respectable, the movie becomes less interesting.
It does, yeah.
It picks up for the crazy finale, like once they're ripping throats out in the lake, it's great again, but there's a middle section where it's just Jackie Treehorn, like, finding ways to, I'm just gonna keep calling him that, just finding ways to fuck with Dalton.
Like the Ford dealership and burning down Reds.
But it's not that interesting, and it's not all that... I don't care about Red, really. Like, I don't care about a lot of those characters. They're just sort of stock characters in this movie. Where I feel like the movie dips, and maybe it's impossible to expect it to maintain the crazy, sweaty energy of the first 45 minutes.
It's interesting that you mention that, because I never felt that way until today when I rewatched it. And today I kind of felt like, ooh, this is really feeling it's 114 minutes.
It's too long.
Like, if you took out some section of that middle and made it an 85, 95 minute movie, I think it would definitely benefit.
And I'm sure that because all the stuff at the beginning when they're getting the bar on its feet is fun and interesting. And then you got the great crazy stuff at the end.
Yeah.
And so I know they don't want to jump. I know they don't want to bridge those two beats with just like a montage of like, hey, the bar is back in business and everybody's wearing red shirts now. because I'm sure they want to show, and maybe this was at Patrick Swayze's insistence, I couldn't say, but that they need to show Dalton being broken down so that we understand how he's driven back to killing people, because that's that defines so much of him in the beginning. So he doesn't want to just easily jump it back into violence. We have to show that, like, okay, these guys have it coming. They just keep fucking with him. But it is repetitive and not super interesting.
I'm also wondering if this was meant to be a longer movie, actually.
No, my God, please no.
Because isn't it weird to you that at the time, like, Keith David was probably one of the better known people in the movie.
Was he?
Because he was in The Thing by then. He was in They Live by then. He's like fifth billed in this movie.
He's in Platoon.
And he's got about two lines.
Yeah, he just shows up as the new bartender. Maybe a lot of
really
his parts did get
strange.
Cut out.
Yeah. It just seems kind of odd and out of
Whiskey's
place.
Whiskey's running low. I know that was one of his lines.
Yeah, I mean, that's problematic. You
but
can't
it's
run
key.
A bar like
that's
that.
Key because they're cutting off the liquor supply. Mm-hmm. I got to say, I'm in...
It's like Prohibition.
Exactly. I think it's super interesting that they cast, I might mispronounce his name, Kevin Tighe?
Teague. Yeah, from Eight Men Out.
As he's always the guy from the Lance Henriksen Tales from the Crypt, where they're playing cards
that's
and betting
great
with one another.
Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah. Because he always plays like, at least in my head, he's always kind of a villain. Like, he's always kind of a slimy guy, and he's not in this. He's like an upstanding guy.
Well, as long as you don't consider like murdering a man in his house, not
okay.
So
but again,
bad.
We just established that Jackie Treehorn had it coming.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. I mean, like. But he didn't hunt Shamu yet, so maybe he didn't have it coming
that's
yet.
True.
He hunted every other animal, but he didn't get
true.
To SeaWorld yet.
That's true.
Because it's interesting you mentioned that with Kevin Teague, because, like, just seeing him in the movie makes you think that something is going to turn with his character, and it never does, and he just kind of comes across as, like, really, like, naive for a bar owner and kind of... Maybe in love with Patrick Swayze a little bit?
Well, everybody's in love with Patrick
no,
Swayze.
No, but, yeah.
Everybody worships at the altar of Patrick Swayze in this movie. He's iconic.
When you mentioned the bar, I don't want to go off the bar turning around for a second.
Yes.
Okay, you know how, like, at the beginning, they've got the chicken wire protecting the Jeff Healey band?
Of course.
Who also, I found out today, has passed away.
Jeff Healey band?
He died in, like, 2009.
I had no idea.
Cancer, too. Everybody in this movie has the cancer. Curse of
Roadhouse.
It's like the Poltergeist.
I did not know Jeff Healey died. Jeff Healey has too many lines in this movie.
Yeah.
And I like him as a presence. And yeah. His music works and all that. And I don't mind the first introduction with him and Dalton. But then later on when he's like delivering exposition about the history between Kelly Lynch and Ben Gazzara, it's like, no, give these to somebody else.
Yeah,
let the chubby guy do it.
Yeah, just say, that's Dalton. That's Garrett.
Did you... I want to let you get back to your chicken wire point, but did you notice as the bar gets better, so does Jeff Healey's hairstylist?
No,
his hair gets a little
bigger.
Oh, yeah,
he's less greasy.
Yeah, it's not all sweaty and matted down. It's more like done up and sprayed in this way.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's what happens. They brought in a stylist. They got the new, Famous Dave's Barbecue polo shirts. They're good.
Yeah.
All right, so, like, there's that girl who sings Knock on Wood, and she's, like, the girl who plays Luke's sister on Gilmore Girls.
Kathleen
she's
Wilhoit.
She's been in stuff.
Oh, yeah, she was in Private School. She's in Murphy's Law.
Yeah.
She's in Witchboard. She kind of irritates me. I feel bad. I mean, in this movie, she's fine.
She
but,
really irritates
oh,
me.
Oh, you
like,
should see her in some other movie. You should see her in Murphy's Law with Charles Bronson.
My point being... she sings Knock on Wood, and that's the point you decide to take the chicken wire down? Like, no one wants to throw a beer. Like, no guy who is
she's
in
the
there...
bartender or the waitress, and they're not going to try and hurt her. I don't know why they keep trying to kill the band that the bar that they love going to every night. Like, this place is great. Let's murder these guys.
I'm pretty sure that director Rowdy Harrington...
We need to talk about
which
that.
We will. Has never been to a bar before.
I mean, I don't know.
Like, I've been to a lot of bars in my...
I have not.
...in my day.
And I would never go to a bar like this, only because I'm such a pussy that I would leave right away. Not because I'm above it, but if I walked in and saw that it looked like this, I would chicken out.
Well, it's okay to say you're above it, because you should be above
a
bar.
No, whatever.
Like that.
I mean...
But I've never... I've probably been to 100 different bars in my lifetime, and I've never seen a bar that even remotely looks like this. And I've been in bars where there have been fights.
Yeah.
And not every table breaks. And this is like a bar where, like, the mugs break when you pour beer in them. Like, it doesn't make any sense how this thing would be in business for more than two nights.
Well, let's talk about Rowdy Harrington, because I know he's made a couple other movies. He made Jack's Back. And he made Striking Distance, which is one of, like, the dullest Bruce Willis movies from
like
that.
One of the worst movies of the 90s.
Just that period
it's
is so
terrible.
Sad. But
he
like,
made another one that actually wasn't... Oh, yeah, I remember what it was. He made Gladiator with Cuba Gooding Jr.
Oh, I never saw that
James
one.
James Marshall,
yeah.
I remember liking that, but I was also 10.
Sure.
So, I don't know.
Was he a stuntman?
Might have been.
This movie has the vibe of a guy who used to be a stuntman, and obviously I don't think Rowdy is his given name. I just feel like the fact that his name is Rowdy Harrington is part of the mythos of Roadhouse. Like, if his name was Tom Harrington, Roadhouse would be 10% less special, and, like, people would care about it less. But it's just this one more piece of trivia on this crazy movie. You're like, oh, and did you know it was directed by a guy named Rowdy? And you're like, of course it was!
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
It absolutely does. Yeah. He directs it like a guy named Rowdy.
He sure does.
I like, at the beginning... I like the sequence where Patrick Swayze just, like, cases the bar and sees all the stuff that's going on. That's interesting to me. But also, I like that his introduction into the movie is when the girl gets, like, kicked in the stomach by another bar patron.
Yeah.
That's Patricia Tallman, who plays...
Oh, from Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead, and she's a stunt woman. She's the pit monster in Army of Darkness. And
get out.
She's the lead in the Night of the Living
You're
Dead.
You're writing
remake.
Her biography? What's going on?
Yeah, yeah, me and Patty T. Yeah. That's what it's called.
The name of it.
So she
it's
gets,
like you're
so
me and Orson Welles.
Exactly. She gets kicked in the stomach. She's a stunt woman, so she gets kicked in the stomach.
Yeah.
And Patrick Swayze talks them outside, and I just feel like... So many other action movies, so many other action stars would insist that that be a beat where he beats their asses. Like, so that right away we see that he's super tough.
Yeah.
But instead, the beat is that he tricks them into walking outside and then walks away peacefully. And again, that's one of the things that I like about Roadhouse, and not ironically, is that the character has a philosophy and the movie sticks to it.
I like it too. I mean, like, one thing I really appreciate about the movie is it has the courage to build a mythos around the cooler.
Right.
Because they obviously wanted to make an updated version of a Western, and they right. couldn't figure out who right. was going to be the gunslinger.
Who's the sheriff,
who's right. going to be the guy to come in to clean up the town
right.
in a bar?
Right.
Like, would it be... Like, who would it be? And it would be a head bouncer who's known from Kansas City to Tuskegee to Tallahassee to whatever. Like, word travels in the bar industry about Garrett and about Dalton.
Right.
Which is just fantastic. So, like, everybody in this bar knows about Dalton and about his mythos. And it just makes it so interesting because those two guys that he kicks out at the beginning and yeah. refuses to fight, they are geared up because they want to fight Dalton.
Right.
They want to see what it's like right. to test their wits with the best to fight Dalton. And I think that's great. It's such a cheat, but it's great character shorthand.
Right. Yeah. That's what's economic storytelling. Yeah, right.
It's really interesting in that sense. And I think the big speech that he has.
Be with, nice.
Yeah. The be nice speech.
It's a great speech.
It's a terrific speech.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not like unironically, it's just really
it's one of those things
speech.
that speech sort of broke out of the movie.
Yeah.
So that even if you're not a fan of Roadhouse and even if you haven't seen it on like TNT 1000 times, like the rest of us have, you would probably know the be nice speech.
Mm-hmm.
Should we talk real, not, I don't have anything to say about this, but I was fascinated watching it this time that when he does finally beat someone up, and then they do the reveal. His name is Dalton, and I don't know how...
Your boy, Jeff
Healey. Jeff Healey knows what's going on.
They know each other, I'm guessing, from a past...
No, I know, but how does Jeff Healey know to announce Dalton at this point?
Because he's got heightened senses.
He's the man without fear?
Yeah. Well, blind people don't fear anything.
There are four separate push-ins before that line. Every character gets a push-in. They just do it over. I think Kathleen Wilhoit gets one, and the blonde girl who gets naked gets one. Jeff Healey gets one. Somebody else. Another.
Is it Teague?
It might be. Okay. Four separate characters get their own push-in before Jeff Healey announces his name is Dalton.
Yeah, it's the best. There's certain touches like that that just make this movie kind of the best in certain ways.
Yeah, I just feel like it's super easy. I mean, it's definitely a movie with a lot of high points. I just feel like it's super easy to say, like, yeah, Roadhouse is ridiculous, and it's awesome because of this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And yes, those things are great. But, like, part of it is that the movie immediately gets written off, or it gets like a reputation for being ridiculous just because it's about bouncers, which paper is like kind of ridiculous. Exactly.
To make a movie around. Yeah.
Right. But obviously they're not really trying to make a movie about bouncers, you know?
And also everybody in the movie kind of gets the movie they're in, which goes a long way.
Yeah, for
to
sure.
Making
for sure.
It what it is. Because, I mean, like, I think that if Ben Gazzara treated it like he was more of a Michael Corleone type, where he's, like, this cold-blooded snake, then it wouldn't be as fun.
Right.
But he plays it to the hilt, and he's so ridiculous. And, like, my favorite Ben Gazzara moment in this is when Patrick Swayze goes over to Ben Gazzara's house after a couple of his henchmen tell him he has to go over there to see Jackie Treehorn. And Ben Gazzara is, you know, just talking. He's talking about how he brought JCPenney to the town, which is just like such. I saw this movie at the Music Box once in a midnight show, and I don't like to hoot and holler and stuff. Right. But like when he said, "I brought JCPenney to the town," I stood up and started doing a slow clap, and people seemed to like that. So, but my favorite line, and the moment where I'm just completely, I don't care who wins this fight, is because I love Brad Wesley so much. Is when Patrick Swayze sees a picture of his uncle or his dad or whatever, and it's a black and white photo, and Patrick Swayze says, "He looks like a really important man," and Jackie Treehorn just goes, "He was an asshole."
See, it explains his motivation.
It's so funny.
But like in addition to it, It's a well-made movie, too, which I think people lose sight of. I mean, it has that sort of Joel Silver slickness to it. It was shot by Dean Cundey, who's like a great cinematographer. Michael Kamen did the score and is very much
It's Lethal Weapon mixed with Die Hard.
Yeah, it's 100%. Especially Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
The fight, the throat-ripping fight is like, this is the score from Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, there's parts of the score from Die Hard where they're just like...
So the stunt work is obviously really good. Like, it's a well-made movie, but back to something you said at the beginning about how all of the, even the henchmen have, you know, sort of short character moments. It's a movie made up of a lot of really good, memorable faces.
Mm-hmm.
So that even including, like, Terry Funk, the wrestler, as one of the...
Was he the curly-haired guy, the really big guy?
Yeah, who gets fired right away for having a temper problem. That guy, you remember that guy, just looking at him. Mm-hmm. Or the big heavyset guy who's in cheerleader camp.
Or the guy who's, like, fake Ted Levine.
Or fake Ted Levine, who more than once I said, is that Ted Levine? Yeah. No, it's not Ted Levine. Okay. Yeah.
And then got the guy who plays Billy, the second in command, who looks like he's out of Step by Step. He looks like Comanche Step by Step.
Yeah, there's just a lot of good, like, sort of character actor faces, which again speaks to it at being a modern Western, because that's all of those Westerns did that, you know.
You know, the part where, like, Billy is in the convertible and they're pulling out of Reds. It's like one of the first times that Patrick Swayze is going to Reds. And there's that second henchman guy and he's in the passenger seat and he's just staring down Patrick Swayze.
Yeah.
I thought that guy, I'm like, he looks like he should have been in The Burning. Like, he just has burning face. He has that, like, upstate New York.
I know the look that you're talking about. So talk about the experience of going to see this at the Music Box, because again, I know this is a movie that's been embraced by hipsters, and midnight shows at the Music Box tend to be...
It's overflowing with hipsters.
Who are patting themselves on the back for going to see Roadhouse.
Yeah, well, I've seen it as a midnight show, I think, twice, because I didn't grow up with Roadhouse. Like, I just saw it for the first time, like, less than 5 years ago.
Oh, maybe. Okay.
But yeah, I was going through my Music Box thing where I mentioned it once. It's kind of like my syllabus for older movies that I haven't like caught up on. So, the first time I saw it, I was just really caught up in just how fun it was.
Right.
Like that was the thing that I came out with, was just how much fun I had with it. And, I think the first time and the second time I saw it, I think a lot of people hadn't seen it before. So I saw it with an audience maybe that was the right audience to see it with, because it was people who were, you know, in their 20s who, like, hadn't had the ironic disposition against it that they might have had if they watched it on TV 100 times. So it was neat because a lot of us were kind of, like, gasping and laughing at the same things because it's so different from... Like, this movie might as well have come out 50 years ago as opposed to, like, 24 years ago.
Sure.
Like, it doesn't... A modern-day action movie doesn't look anything like Roadhouse.
A modern-day now or a modern-day in 1989?
I can't speak for 1989 too much, but, like, even... More like a 2013 action movie.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, 100%.
It looks like... You know, at best, The Last Stand, and at worst, like, The Escape Plan. So,
right. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. I'm even trying to think of, like, if there's any direct-to-video stuff that kind of resembles Roadhouse, but it doesn't really, you know. And certainly, I'm kind of more of a mark for this kind of thing, because I just like 80s action movies, and this movie has that, the look and feel of that. I gotta give Roadhouse credit for just being a movie that's sort of about... bar fights that essentially sustains the vibe and the energy of like a 2-hour bar fight. I mean, that's really what it feels like for the whole movie. It creates, you know, for the most part, a good sense of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe part of why I start to check out, is because as much as I would never go into a bar like this one, as it does start to turn into like a TGI Fridays, it's so much less interesting to me.
Yeah,
you know, it's way more interesting when all the tables and chairs are breaking and there's beer on the floor and the band is behind chicken wire. When it turns into a Fridays, I'm less interested. I pinpointed while we were talking the exact moment that I did check out. And it's when the blonde girl is doing like the strip dance that exists just for...
To have a strip dance.
To have a girl do a strip dance who's been threatening to get naked the whole movie and hasn't yet. What the hell is that scene? It goes on for way too long.
I really like that scene.
Dude.
And here's the reasons why. One is because it starts out with Ben Gazzara, sorry, Jackie Treehorn, saying, play something with balls. And then Jeff Healey, as if he doesn't know who's telling him to do that, just mindlessly starts playing a song. Like, brr, 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 brr. He just starts playing it, and he's got, like, a big grin on his face. And I'm just kind of like, dear, it's like in Anchorman when Brick forgets what side he's on. And I really like that about it.
Okay.
Two, she looks like a girl that I knew in high school.
Okay.
Three, I think she's very pretty.
She is.
And I think she should have been the girl that Dalton ends up with instead of Doc. Because Doc's boring.
And that would have almost, like, made sense if they had made some different choices in the movie. But again, they're really trying to make the argument that Dalton is not of that world. Even though he exists in that world, he's not of that world. And she's too much of that world.
Yeah,
he's,
but as Django said, you gotta get dirty sometimes.
No, I agree with you. I totally agree. And I would be more interested in a movie. Because as the movie goes on, and Swayze goes dark, like, I thought, oh, this is actually really interesting. You don't typically see this.
Because he's, like, this pacifist who's losing his cool.
Exactly, and you don't usually see that in an action movie. Like, you would see him rip the guy's throat out in a last-minute sort of life, self-defense gesture, and then feel bad about it and stare at the blood on his hands and feel guilty.
He kind of does that a little
bit. No, he absolutely does that. But that would have been the only moment where it's like, oh, what have I done? But you get all that stuff building up to it where he's, like, smoking and kind of going crazy and, like, really ready to fight and sort of embracing this violence that's in his past. And you just don't usually get that.
I got to ask you two questions, action-related.
All right.
Why do you think so many – it seems like every action star, especially of the 80s and 90s, seem to have one of these where they kind of go down country –
okay.
Because you got Steven Seagal in Fire Down Below.
Right.
You've got
Van Damme, does Van Damme
and Nowhere to Run. Yeah. You've got Swayze in this.
Yeah.
Like, is it just kind of in the playbook, like, that you have? And maybe, like, Statham in Homefront? I don't know. Like,
probably,
Is it just kind of in the playbook, or is there, like,
I think it's more just about, well, how do we change it up this time? We've seen you. We've seen you fight crime in New York City. Mm-hmm. Let's see you fight crime down south. I mean, I think it's really just sort of that it also, basic.
It also seems to be the one where they decide to test out their music skills, because Swayze has two songs.
Yeah, he does.
On the soundtrack. Seagal sang a whole lot of songs in Fire Down Below.
Boy, does he.
And he fixed a lot of porches. I've only seen Martin Fire Down Below once, but I kind of like Fire Down Below.
It's okay.
Like, I think it's really kind of sweet in a way.
Almost. It is. Yeah. It is. The heavy action column that I've always planned to do is that and Nowhere to Run, for that reason, where they sort of play the outsider who comes to the southern town. And, because I'm a big fan of Nowhere to Run, actually.
Yeah, he definitely comes to the southern town.
Well, Rosanna Arquette is a fox. Mm-hmm.
Some of that Culkin money.
Fire Down Below is kind of the movie where it starts to switch for Steven Seagal, where he really starts going down the path of, like, not so much building his own legend, but, like, following his own crazy obsessions, where he just believes that he's, like, part Native American, and he's gonna talk about the environment, and he's gonna play guitar, and, like, these are the things that he's into.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is much more on his terms, and he goes down that road for a little while.
Yeah.
He's not there anymore, but...
But I find that so much more interesting than... It seems like, with the exception of Homefront or maybe The Last Stand, is this kind of the same thing where it's like...
Yeah, Last Stand is another sort of,
There's so much, and I think it's just a cost-cutting method, but, like, so many of the modern action movies are, like, in Bulgaria.
Right, for sure, yeah.
And it's, there's, the problem with that is there's just nothing interesting to look at.
Right.
So you're really dependent on the sheen of the action star in that movie because you're just in this gross, ugly, Eastern block-looking area. So, I don't know. I mean, that's just kind of another reason I think I like Roadhouse, is just because it's very bright, and it's kind of like a lot of... There's a lot of life to it. It's not like... I don't know. It's the type of movie where, like, you definitely feel like this town existed before Patrick Swayze came into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I would absolutely agree with that. Yeah. The only other thing I was going to say, I think a lot of that too has to do with, again, Dean Cundey's photography is, mm-hmm. is really, really great. Talking about Bulgaria real quick, you know, one of the other problems too with all the action movies shot in Bulgaria is that so many of them will often try and disguise the fact. Mm-hmm. Or they just don't want to let you know too much that you're in Bulgaria. And so that leads to that awful choppy editing style where in order to disguise the fact that the locations look like an abandoned nuclear power plant, mm-hmm. They just cut it up real fast and then they color time it so that everything's just gray.
Yeah.
And there's a sameness to all those movies now that mm-hmm. is depressing. And Roadhouse, again, doesn't have that. It lets sort of these fist fights play out in, like, longer masters. And you get the sense, again, like you do watching old Westerns, that you're just seeing an entire room full of employed stuntmen. And it's great.
Exactly. Yeah, and there's even certain things about it that are so silly, but I really like the fact that, like, the opening credits are, like, in pink letters. Sure. That's, like, the cocktail move.
Right.
So it's kind of, like...
There's a cocktail vibe in this
movie. There's a lot of, like, 80s bar stuff going on.
Yeah, because he ends up in the water with Kelly Lynch, just like...
And Kelly Lynch was in Cocktail.
She was, and Tom Cruise is in the waterfall with Elizabeth Shue in Cocktail. Yeah.
Cocktail has one of the funniest opening credit moments.
I hate Cocktail.
I don't like it either.
I cannot stand. Erica quotes it constantly, and I cannot stand that movie.
That's like her swordfish. Like
it might be.
I wouldn't even know what if somebody quoted Cocktail at me. I wouldn't even know what you're.
I have learned now certain movies that she'll quote where I don't know the quotes because I've seen Cocktail twice. But I'm like, I'll bet that's a Cocktail line.
I had one of those where, like, I heard a quote forever, and then I saw The Sure Thing, and I'm like, oh, it's from The Sure Thing.
What was the quote, do you know?
It was Nick's your buddy. Nick's kind of guy you'd like to have a beer with.
Yeah.
No, the part in Cocktail that I always, like, crack up at with the opening credits is when they say Tom Cruise on the screen.
Yeah.
And it's at a part where he's in a car with a bunch of his buddies, and they basically, like, have him stand up and, like, take a bow.
Oh, right.
And I'm just like, oh, man.
I don't like Cocktail at all.
Wasn't that made by Roger Donaldson?
It might have been.
Who has made some decent movies.
Sure. I know he has, but he's one of these guys.
He did, like, No Way Out. And I know you, like, make fun of, like, rightfully so, the Elmer Fudd voice, but 13 Days is actually a really good movie.
But he's one of these guys.
Species.
Who? Species. Do you like Species?
I like the first Species.
Oh, God. No. Mark Helgenberger, get back to your porch. Roger Donaldson, he's just one of those guys who, like, he's like a John Badham or a John Avildsen or even like a John Turteltaub. A lot of Johns.
How dare you with the John
Avildsen. But I'm just saying, like, but John Avildsen made, you know, one or two good movies. I know he made Saturday Night Fever. I know.
I mean, no, he didn't.
Who am I thinking of?
Badham.
Oh, well, you're, Badham, you're right. I'm confused.
Badham made Saturday Night Fever.
I'm confusing the two. But then they make a lot of garbage also, so I'm just never sure which one I'm seeing, you know,
like okay,
which guy I get. The opening shot of Roadhouse I actually really like, where it the car parks and the woman's feet step out and it sort of pans up the woman as she walks into the bar, and it's this long tracking shot, because to me that's Rowdy Harrington sort of saying, like, here's the movie you're about to see, you know. It sort of, he spells out everything in that opening shot sort of in terms of the tone of what the movie's going to be.
It would have been cool if the opening shot was, like, The Shining, where you just, like, are slowly getting to the double deuce, and there's ominous music, and it's pink lettering, and it's the Jeff Healey band still playing
something with balls.
Yeah, I think everything that the Jeff Healey band plays sounds the same.
Well, it's all covers, pretty much, in this movie.
Yeah, but, like, they make Roadhouse Blues sound like...
ZZ Top, right.
I mean, like, it sounds... like the same
not
song.
Knock on Wood, though.
That's where you need the chicken. So you take the,
and I can't even stomach listening to that, because the definitive version of Knock on Wood to me is Justine Bateman and Mystery in Satisfaction, because a killer version of Knock on Wood where she's holding a cowbell. She's playing cowbell on that one. She's literally jumping up and down pounding on the cowbell.
Are you, like, serious, like, you like it, or, like, you not sure you're
serious? No, I genuinely love it, but I recognize that that instance, it's probably ironic.
Was she trying to be a singer for a while? No, but she did Light of Day also, where she was a singer.
No, that was Michael J. Fox.
No, but it was Justine Bateman, too.
Joan Jett. played the lead in Light of Day.
God bless it.
So they both have played musicians, the Keatons. Right. And then Teeny Others became a musician in real life. They're such a musical family.
Yeah.
Michael J. Fox played guitar in that the Bar Busters. That was that band. Okay. And Joan Jett played the lead.
I like the song Light of Day by Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen. That's actually kind of a good movie, and for whatever reason has never been released on DVD.
Really?
Yeah. It's Paul Schrader, too, which you would think.
Paul Schrader did that?
Yep. You would think it would be, it's like this weird drama between Joan Jett and Jenna Rowlands. And,
I've got so much affection for these late 80s movies that I was too young to see when they came out. And then like, I'm coming back to them. Cause like forever I would always ask my mom to watch a movie for me when I was too young to,
right.
And then I would ask her to tell me about it. And I don't know if she ever did it or not, but or she just made up a yarn for me.
Yeah.
But like I asked her to do that for The Lost Boys before I ever saw it. She did that for me for Bright Lights, Big City because my sister and I loved Family Ties, but we weren't ready to watch.
I was dying to see Bright Lights, Big City.
Him doing drugs and stuff. And then I finally caught up with it, and it's not
that good.
It's not very good.
No.
No.
I definitely was able. I either like snuck a watch on HBO or like convince my mom to let me rent it or whatever, but it's not very good. But anything with Michael J. Fox back in the day, I was on board for. Your mom did take you to see Jetsons the movie.
She totally did.
So
that's
pretty awesome.
It's pretty empty. that was around the time where I saw Arachnophobia in the theater, and I was scared by the spider jumping in the jar.
Yeah,
and then. This was at the Ridge Cinemas. Do you remember Ridge Cinemas?
I never went, but I know of them,
So, so the spider jumped in the jar, so my dad will never let me live this down. He's like, do you remember what you said to me? And I'm like, what? He's like, Mr. Horror Movie Guy, you remember what you said to me? And I'm like, no, what? He goes, you said, I think we better leave now. And then my sister and my mom were going to see Ghost, and we went into the theater to watch Ghost, which I probably couldn't handle either, if I couldn't handle Arachnophobia, but we couldn't find a seat because it was the summer of 90, and it was the summer of Ghost.
Right.
So we ended up in a theater watching Taking Care of Business.
Oof. Written by J.J. Abrams?
No.
Yeah?
Oh, my God. And
his first screenplay that he sold, I think.
Yeah, and my dad still won't talk to me. Over that.
But at least he learned what the word philofax means.
Yeah, that he did.
That's what I learned from that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Ghost, and then we'll wrap up. Ghost was one of those movies that is in the Romancing the Stone Princess Bride category, which was a movie I had no interest in seeing at all and went because, like, other people were going or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, like, flipped out for.
That's cool.
I probably saw Ghost 8 times in 1990.
I saw it at least once or twice in 1990.
Yeah.
Because when my sister and my mom saw it, they loved it. So they told my dad and I to go watch it with them again. And it's funny because when I was out of town recently, I watched 20 minutes of it in the hotel.
Okay.
And I really want to watch Ghost again. some stuff, it's so fucking romantic. It's just lovely.
Swayze.
Yeah.
So the only thing, at the end, he should have ripped out Oda Mae's throat. But otherwise, Ghost is a solid movie. if you guys haven't seen Roadhouse, you're missing out. Don't watch it ironically. Just watch it as an updated Western, and you will have a great time with it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Don't watch it ironically. There's enough fun to not do that.
Yeah, right? It's a waste of everyone's time to watch something ironically. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving, and we will talk to you next week.
Ta-da!